Hello, and welcome to the New World. Episode 8, Aztec Ascension. Before we begin, let me apologize for being gone so long. I've just graduated college, and I went from the time-consuming process of finals to the time-consuming process of moving to the time-consuming process of finding a job. Now that things in my life are finally beginning to stabilize a little bit, and I have a new microphone, I can get back to doing this in my downtime. Last time, we covered the Spanish expansion across the Caribbean Sea. Beyond simply covering the events themselves, I wanted to mention many of the figures who will become even bigger names later on. Bartolomé de las Casas, Francisco Pizarro, and Hernán Cortés. We'll definitely be seeing more of him later on, but not for a while. Nor will we be seeing any European for that matter, because it's finally time to talk about the Aztecs. I've been looking forward to talking about them, because even though I created this podcast with the intention to give a bit of more in-depth story to Native American peoples, I haven't mentioned them much, instead in favor of the European activities. In addition, a lot of history teachers usually only mention the history of Mexico as soon as the Europeans land. I don't want to give you a complete history of pre-Columbian Mesoamerica, but I do want to give the Aztecs their day in the sun before this whole region changes forever. Be aware, though, that I'm about to throw quite a bit of unfamiliar names and terminology at you in a language I really can't pronounce that well. I'll try to limit and simplify things a bit, and I'll try my best to keep us all immersed in this very unique time and place. So, without further ado, here is the brief history of the Aztec Empire. Contrary to what you might think, the people of the Americas have not been sitting around in the wilderness for the last 1,000 years or so. Mesoamerica, literally meaning between the two Americas, was a highly developed, well-populated region with an intriguing political history going back just as long as Europe's. The Olmec civilization had been farming corn and beans there since 1500 BC, and the peoples that succeeded them built great cities which were the equal of any in the world, complete with monuments, temples, markets, and workshops. You might even compare these city-states to those of ancient Greece or even Renaissance Italy. There were dozens of such places among a huge variety of languages and cultures. There were the Huastecs, Zapotecs, Mayans, Tarascans, Mixtecs, and more, always fighting with one another to see who would be the most powerful. It was Teotihuacan that became the greatest of them. Since its founding in 400 BC, it had become the dominant political power in the region. Hundreds of thousands of people lived there. They built massive pyramids and had huge paved streets and exquisite craftsmanship. But a great rebellion by the working class of the city in 650 AD effectively destroyed the aristocracy, and the city fell into ruin. They may have been succeeded by the Toltec civilization, but scholars are starting to doubt that they actually existed for various reasons that I won't get into here. What we do know for a fact is that up to the northwest, in the area of modern New Mexico and Arizona, a large group of people known as the Chichimecs, or barbarians, began to migrate south. They spoke a language known as Nahuatl and claimed common ancestry from a place called Aztlan. We don't know where this Aztlan really was, but considering Nahuatl shares linguistic similarities to languages like Ute from modern Utah, we can take a guess. If you're wondering, these Chichimecs from Aztlan are the people we might call the Aztecs. The term Aztec is actually an anachronistic one, created in the 19th century. They did not call themselves Aztec, nor did anyone else, not even the Spanish. Like any mass migration of peoples, the movement of the Chichimecs was a slow process. Over the years, and over centuries, and over generations, these Chichimecs worked their way southward, similar to the way Germanic peoples worked their way down into the borders of the Roman Empire. The first waves established cities and kingdoms of their own, and soon much of central Mexico spoke Nahuatl. In her book Fifth Son, Camilla Townsend tells an interesting, if pretty romanticized, story. One of these groups, the Mexica, happened to find themselves in the service of the Nahuatl king of Culhuacan. The king did not like the Mexica one bit, but he found them to be a useful people. He gave them one impossible task after another, like when he had them capture a deer without hurting it or moving an entire farm to someplace else. Each time, they returned with the task complete, and each time the king gave them a more difficult task. One day, he allowed his people to build a temple to their patron god Huitzilopochtli, and when he saw an eagle land on its roof, he knew that the Mexica were a truly blessed people that he could not destroy. So he released them from their bondage and allowed them to leave Culhuacan. The Mexica wandered for a long time. They did not want to submit themselves to another king, but there was little good land for them to seize. One day, on the swampy shores of Lake Texcoco, they at last found their sign. A priest received a vision from Huitzilopochtli that he would soon see an eagle warming itself in the sun. Lo and behold, they soon found an eagle, perched upon a cactus, eating a snake. It was clear that Huitzilopochtli wanted his people to settle here. However, this cactus was on an island in the lake. Making a city on the lake seems a difficult task, but the Mexica were no strangers to difficult tasks. It was here, on this island, that they founded Tenochtitlan in the year 1325. The Mexica's ruler sat upon a customary reed mat in lieu of a throne, and was known as the Tlatoani. You might call them kings, but the term more specifically translates to speaker, because they spoke for their people. He was elected by a group of elders rather than descended primogeniture like the monarchs of Europe. This did not mean, of course, that most of the rulers came from one particular family. They often did. Some people refer to the Tlatoani as chief, but I think that's honestly a bit of a derogatory term, because it conjures up the wrong mental image. A chief rules a tribe, after all, and nowhere in central Mexico could you find something fitting that description. You certainly could not find one in Tenochtitlan, which in a few decades had been well established as a bustling town among artificial islands built on the lake. These islands were built by piling earth between wooden walls which wedged into the shallow mud. Between islands were built canals and causeways, then bridges and streets. Huts turned to houses, and houses turned into neighborhoods. An urban upper class known as the Pipiltin distinguished themselves from the commoners, the Masahualtin. The spot of the eagle and the cactus became the foundations of a massive pyramid. I want to save a lot of discussion of Tenochtitlan and Aztec society for its own episode, but just know for now that the Mexica were quickly developing into a proper power in their own right, as well as an independent political entity among many in the central Mexican basin. Things really began to get complicated for the Mexica in 1426. This was the year that the Tlatoani of the nearby city of Azcapotzalco died. His sons fought for the throne, and Maxtla, half-brother of the heir presumptive, won the throne via a coup. He decided to make the very smart decision of betraying all of his city's former allies, all of whom were married to his murdered king. So, of course, he invited the ruler of the Mexica, Chimalpopoca, to a dinner in his palace. In a move right out of an HBO drama, Maxtla had him strangled to death when he sat down to eat. The death of Chimalpopoca caused the panic elites in Tenochtitlan to select Itzcoatl, his son, as the next Tlatoani. He would have been a middle-aged man by that time, as well as a seasoned war leader. Just the man the city needed to win a war against the city of Azcapotzalco. To oppose Maxtla and his powerful city, Itzcoatl assembled an alliance. First was the Tepanec city of Tlacopan, who also had a member of their royalty killed by Maxtla and were eager to join in. Next was the Alcohua city of Texcoco, a well-respected town that was also a former client state of Azcapotzalco, the city now ruled by Maxtla. It had rebelled against Azcapotzalco years before, but the rebellion was brutally put down by Maxtla's father. They eagerly joined Itzcoatl to free themselves of Azcapotzalco's tyranny. Although all four cities were almost direct neighbors and sat on the shores of Lake Texcoco, things took longer than you might think. The war against Mashtla lasted several years, but by its end, the Triple Alliance had triumphed, and now ruled as an unofficial empire over the whole of the central Mexican basin, with Tenochtitlan as its clear head. Itzcoatl was now Hue Tlatoani, or High Speaker. He is better served by the title of Emperor. I know I threw a lot of names at you just then, but the main thing you should take from this is that the Triple Alliance was formed by Itzcoatl, and that his city, Tenochtitlan, now sat as the hegemon of central Mexico. The Mexica, aka the Aztecs, once the new kids on the block, were now running the whole neighborhood. This is what you might recognize as the Aztec Empire. As I said earlier, it wasn't really an empire in the traditional sense. In fact, it wasn't even really an official political body. It was more like a sphere of influence, with the Mexica's ruler as the hegemon. No one in the central Mexican basin was more powerful than the alliance of Texcoco, Tlacopan, and Tenochtitlan, and no one was more powerful in that alliance than that last city. Of the three, they were the strongest, both in terms of population and military strength. The various city-states of the region retained their political autonomy, either as individual cities or in leagues. However, more and more of these little states began to pay taxes to the Triple Alliance in recognition of their obvious power. Mesoamerica had no coinage, so these were payments of goods that those places produced, from corn to chocolate to cotton. Of course, one item paid in tribute stands out among all others, and that was people. Human sacrifices, to be more specific. If there's one thing you've likely seen about Central American civilizations in popular culture, it's that they engaged in regular religious sacrifices. These sorts of things are not at all uncommon in polytheistic religions. The Greco-Roman tradition involves sacrificing animals like cattle, for example, and doing so while the animals were still alive. Live animals could be offered to appease the gods, or for things like haruspication, the reading of entrails to predict future events. Human sacrifice is, of course, a rarity, maybe due to the severity of the act. I mean, even God didn't let Abraham sacrifice Isaac, even though Abraham wanted to. To the Aztecs, the gods controlled everything. If they were not appeased, they could destroy the entire world in their fury, as they had done many times before. In fact, the Aztecs believed they were currently living in the fifth such incarnation of the Earth. The only way to satisfy the gods, then, was to show them the most extreme display of devotion. This included less extreme but still pretty hardcore practices like bleeding themselves as well. If you're familiar with popular depictions of the Aztecs or Mayans, I'm sure a particular mental image comes to mind. That of a priest atop a pyramid holding the recently removed heart of a sacrifice to the jubilation of thousands of cheering townspeople. Mel Gibson's Mayan movie Apocalypto certainly did nothing to dispute that. This is certainly far from the truth. The Mexica were well aware of just how serious a human sacrifice was, and they treated it as such. Spectators were often silent and respectful of sacrifices. Those screaming crowds going crazy at the sight of blood were really more common in Europe, where public executions were performed in town squares to reaffirm the authority of a ruler, or as particularly severe punishment of crimes, like treason. That doesn't mean the Aztecs' sacrifices were willing, though. In the later stages of the empire, most of these people were prisoners, often taken in battle or as tribute from a subservient city-state. Those who were brought to Tenochtitlan were placed in any number of places in the city, from the central temple pyramids to any of the outlying neighborhoods. They were either sacrificed by the city priests or sold into slavery to be sent elsewhere. Make no mistake, while Aztec sacrificial rites weren't as totally brutal as you might think, human sacrifice is still an utterly barbaric practice, no matter how necessary it may have seemed to the people even at the time. Emperor Itzcoatl ruled the Aztecs for 14 years. In a short amount of time, he had expanded their power greatly. When he died in 1440, he was succeeded by his nephew, Moctezuma. Moctezuma, also pronounced as Montezuma, was born in 1398, his mother being a princess from the rich city of Cuernavaca, and his father being the Mexica king Huitzilopochtli. This meant that his brother was Chimalpopoca, who had so recently been strangled to death by Maxtla back in 1426. Itzcoatl had chosen the warrior Moctezuma to succeed him over his own family. Why? Well, not only was Moctezuma's branch of the family still very powerful politically, but Itzcoatl had married a princess from Azcapotzalco as part of the peace settlement, and no one wanted an emperor descended from the people they had just conquered. Upon reaching the throne, though, Moctezuma decided that he would make a similar deal and announced that none of his sons would inherit the throne either on his death. He then went on to be the most successful and long-lived ruler in pre-Columbian history, just about anyway. Over the next 29 years, he would lead the Aztecs to even higher heights of expansion, of domination, of construction, and of sophistication. He conquered the modern state of Oaxaca to the south, and cities on the Gulf Coast pledged their allegiance to him as well. Trade goods from across not only the Central Valley, but all over Mesoamerica made their way to Tenochtitlan's marketplace. When a drought hit the empire, aqueducts and pipes were built to carry fresh water into the city. Things were getting better all the time for the Mexica. While the Triple Alliance was certainly a dominating force in the region, it had several enemies who refused to be subjugated. Take the Tlaxcala, for example. Nestled in the pine forests of eastern Mexico, the four city-states of the Tlaxcalans routinely opposed the Aztecs at every turn. They were too strong to be conquered, even by the military might of Tenochtitlan, and they refused any demand to pay tribute, no matter how light. The priests in the emperor's court demanded more and more sacrifices, though, and Tlaxcala was a strong opponent. How, then, could they sate the appetites of the clergy while not throwing away their whole army? The solution was the Flower Wars. These were ritualistic battles where the two sides, those being the Aztecs and their enemies, met at a predetermined time and place and engaged in a struggle that wasn't so much about winning as it was about fighting. The Aztecs used no ranged weapons, instead preferring to fight their enemies one-on-one. When the fighting was done, the armies retired with a haul of prisoners to be enslaved or sacrificed. That all sounds awfully pointless, but consider the benefits. Sacrifices to the gods could be gained through prisoners taken. Armies could be trained in battle without much danger of taking massive casualties. Individual warriors could also show their prowess on the battlefield in full view of their comrades, most of whom were nobility themselves. Finally, the Aztecs and their unconquerable enemies, like the Tlaxcalans, could tell their citizens that they were doing something to respond to the threats those places posed. It was a good deal for everyone. But it didn't stop the Aztecs and Tlaxcalans from seeing each other as mortal enemies. This would prove to be the undoing of their entire civilization when the Tlaxcalans suddenly found themselves a very strong ally on the shores of the Caribbean Sea. The year 1469 brought about the end of Moctezuma's life. True to his word, it was Itzcoatl's grandson, Axayacatl, who was elected, rather than one of Moctezuma's own children. Axayacatl ruled for 12 successful years, marked by even further expansion. I won't go too much into detail, but for fun, let's list two interesting events that Camilla Townsend notes. Firstly, Axayacatl found himself at war with the nearby city of Tlatelolco, which was actually so nearby that it was practically a suburb of Tenochtitlan. I mean, the two cities were on the same island, literally within direct line of sight from one another. This city had been an ally of Tenochtitlan since their city's founding, but after decades living in the shadow of the growing metropolis, the people of Tlatelolco grew restless and resentful. The emperor's sister, once the primary wife of Tlatelolco's Tlatoani, had not only been demoted, but stripped of any status and had been forced to live with the servants. He even took her fine clothes and confiscated any gifts given to her by her brother. When she eventually escaped and made her way back to Tenochtitlan, which wasn't that far away, she told her brother all about what had happened to her and that the king of that city was gathering his forces to march on the Aztec capital. After a few brief battles, the Aztecs triumphed, and the king of Tlatelolco either jumped from the top of his pyramid or was thrown off of his pyramid to his death. The second interesting incident happened when the Triple Alliance member city Texcoco, who, upon the death of its king, was embroiled in a succession war between the king's 60 sons. You heard that right. 60 sons. Not all of them fought for the throne, of course, but even a small fraction of them would have still been too many. In any case, Axayacatl made sure that his preferred candidate sought upon the reed mat that substituted for a throne. After Axayacatl died in 1481, the throne changed hands a little quicker. His half-brother Tizoc died after about 5 years in power, possibly from poison. Tizoc's brother Ahuitzot followed and ruled until about 1502. Throughout all of this time, under every emperor, no matter how successful, the Aztecs expanded further and further. Here and there, such as in the cities of Tlatelolco or Chalco, a rebellious city would see its royal family thrust out of power, replaced by an Aztec governor who would more directly control the territory for the leaders back in Tenochtitlan. Things were a bit of an administrative mess and needed proper reorganization. That reorganizer proved to be Moctezuma. No, not that Moctezuma. The new Moctezuma. Moctezuma the Younger. The son of Axayacatl, Moctezuma, came to sit on the reed mat and realized that this whole Aztec Empire thing needed a little more empire in it. Sure, even the Triple Alliance's territory was huge, but it was a huge mess. Tributes came in and uneven amounts at different times. Some cities ruled completely unaffected by Aztec control, and laws differed from place to place. Merchants traveled as far as the island of Cozumel and beyond, but without government support, they were easy prey for bandits or, worse, price gouging. All the while, Tenochtitlan's population was exploding into hundreds of thousands, and it needed a constant supply of food, water, and slaves to keep it running. Moctezuma II set about reorganizing this big old administrative laundry basket. He set up 38 administrative districts, run by loyal Mexica and supported by permanent garrisons of Aztec soldiers. Calendars were synchronized among every city under Aztec control to ensure that they all paid tribute on the scheduled days. Although most kings were allowed to rule as they always had, administrative officials sent out from Tenochtitlan also acted as diplomats and judges, ensuring that things like marriages and land disputes were resolved in a way most pleasing to Moctezuma's government. Any upstart Tlatoani who resisted would find a military force at the doorstep of his palace, ready to throw him out and bring his city under even more direct control. Over the next 16 years, the Triple Alliance became a more centralized bureaucracy, a vibrant and increasingly efficient empire the likes of which Mexico had never seen, even in the heyday of the Mayans or Teotihuacan a long time ago. But despite all of Moctezuma's success, there were cracks growing at the foot of his pyramid. The flower wars with Tlaxcala continued, with the Aztecs losing a big battle as late as the 1510s. His reforms and oversight over the other Triple Alliance cities certainly seemed to have ruffled a few feathers, particularly those who were used to not having a Mexica official standing over their shoulder, deciding who their Tlatoani got to bestow land upon. All the while, the priests at the temples of Huitzilopochtli, the god of war, and Tlaloc, the rain god, demanded more and more sacrifices to keep the favor of those gods. Conquered cities like Tlatelolco sent more of their sons to Tenochtitlan, only to be killed to keep Moctezuma's son spinning around the earth. Trouble was brewing, and it only needed a group of well-armed strangers from across the bay to set a fire and burn the Aztec Empire to the ground.